Good morning. You are tuned to listener-supported community radio at KBOO Portland. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, the moles take up a number of contemporary issues of interest to our listeners. Bill Resnick and Jan Hawkins start off the hour with a discussion of adolescent mental health, challenging conventional narratives about the nature of the so-called crisis in teenage mental health. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews a novel about a brilliant woman scientist forced out of the academy by men, and believe it or not, it's a funny and satisfying story. In part three of his interview with President-elect of the National Library Association, Joe Clement explores where libraries might fit in with the Green New Deal. And I'll close the show with a reading and commentary by Bill Resnick about the U.S. strategy to bleed Russia dry as a lesson to China. This kind of commentary is what you've grown to expect on KBOO. Please support KBOO if you can by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321. And every dollar donated will be matched up to $7,000 through a generous grant from anonymous donors. Let's get started this morning with Jan Hawken and Bill Resnick facing off against the New York Times. The Times recently published a series entitled, It's Life or Death, the Mental Health Crisis Among U.S. Teens. Jan contends, however, that teens are doing better than ever on many measures, and that the problems they have are rooted in the current climate crisis, widespread immiseration within marginalized communities, and the erosion of democratic rights. But teens themselves are fighting back against these problems. Here's Bill and Jan.
Hi, folks. Today, fellow old mole Jan Hawken and I, Bill Resnick, will discuss an alleged teenage mental health crisis. This discussion subject came to us by the New York Times, who published an article, actually a series of articles, the first one titled, It's Life or Death, the Mental Health Crisis Amongst U.S. Teens, very ominous. It begins their article, and I quote, Depression, self-harm, and suicide are rising among American adolescents. For one 13-year-old, the despair was almost too much to take. And then it describes this poor person. The Times then legitimated this warning of teenage mental health emergency by citing its sources. Here's again the Times, and I quote, In December, in a rare public advisory, the U.S. Surgeon General warned of a devastating mental health crisis among adolescents. Numerous hospital and doctor groups have called it a national emergency, citing rising levels of mental illness, a severe shortage of therapists and treatment options, and insufficient research to explain the trend. Jan Hawken, welcome to KBOO as a guest. Welcome to the Old Mole.
It's good to be talking with you about these serious problems.
Yes. Jan Hawken's a psychologist. For many years, he directed the Portland State University Psych Department's counseling unit. It trains people for counseling jobs across the economy. Jan's three books include Psychiatry, Politics, and PTSD, that's post-traumatic stress disorder. And much of her writing on PTSD, on recovered memory of past abuse, on alleged satanic rituals and child care programs, in much of this writing, Jan critiques the tendency of psychologists and practitioners to exaggerate and sometimes fabricate the social problem that needs more attention. So, Jan, evaluate for us this devastating mental health crisis. How would you describe the situation of today's teens?
Well, like many reports of social crisis or what some call periods of moral panic when a particular issue crosses a threshold from a group gathering and organizing around a social problem to becoming identified as an acute and urgent problem that calls for a major shift in investment of resources. There's always something to it, as well as ways in which experts are competing in ways to frame and name the problem. And a lot of my work focuses on not just people who suffer mental health conditions or are diagnosed with conditions, but the conflict among experts who have various levels of authority in coming to terms with and calling for funding and support for services. I think it's interesting with this new data on suicidality in youth and the pandemic that these trends preceded the pandemic by some years, as some of the data started in 2008 to 2010, increasing rates of suicide attempts and suicide, particularly among vulnerable youth, youth of color, LGBTQ youth. But I think the pandemic has opened up space for more of a public health response to the problems of youth. That, you know, it doesn't take a psychiatrist to know that the pandemic has exacerbated a lot of problems for young people as well as for their caregivers. You know, youth centers have closed, schools have been shut down or curtailed services. So a lot of the ways in which young people find support and what are called the buffering effects or resilience factors, areas where youth are supported that reduces the likelihood of a psychiatric episode, including a suicide attempt, you know, there's been a loss of those services over the pandemic, but that's exacerbated a longer-term loss of public services for youth and support services for youth. So here, I think getting back to some of the data published by hospital psychiatrists, there are more youth presenting during the pandemic in emergency rooms, but that has been going on for a long time as well, that we've relied in this country on hospital emergency rooms for mental health care for decades because there are fewer services available outside of the criminal justice system. And so I think the answer isn't more psychiatric beds, which some psychiatrists are calling for, but there's another set of calls that are more oriented toward education and public health. So that's another, I think, point to take up. What this emergency or crisis is calling for specifically, and that's when you start digging into the numbers and how people are framing the crisis, where there's some differences that emerge in terms of what we need to do about the problems that youth confront.
Yeah, the Times defined the problem mostly in terms of the personal lives of these kids being disrupted. They looked at individual cases of kids and then extrapolated from that to the whole population. They got a letter back from a number of letters that gently critiqued them, too gently is my sense, but they're looking for causes in the wrong places, basically. Let me read to you the letter, and then we can comment on the very different way of understanding young people today. So here's the letter. As the mother of two teenage daughters, I'm grateful for your coverage of teens' mental health. I have observed many of the conditions described in your articles and in the accompanying video. Well, that was very complimentary, actually. But here comes the critique. One element that I think was underplayed, in fact, it wasn't there at all in any of the articles, was the effect of teens' external environments on their mental health. We are living in the midst of climate collapse. We have to work harder and take on more debt to afford the same things people enjoyed 50 years ago. Our healthcare system is in shambles. Racial injustice and economic equality persist unabated. And, of course, teens recognize, especially those who don't meet the competitive standards in our schools, that their future is extremely precarious. A family wage job is harder and harder to find.
Yeah,
why don't you comment?
I think I've been interested in the history of adolescence, and child psychiatry have written quite a bit about it, the history of diagnoses as they're applied to youth. And it's interesting how the child guidance movement and the concept of adolescence coined by G. Stanley Hall, a psychologist in 1904, they were really reacting to a wave of concern in cities around the U.S. and in London to truancy and juvenile delinquency and a concern about gangs. And so this child guidance movement had much of that same ethos you're describing in the letter, that young people are getting in trouble because they're entering into a society that is demanding new things of them. They're mobile in ways that leave them unanchored. So the concerns about youth as a group that is kind of in this threshold state between the protected sphere of childhood and the responsibilities we're expecting of people to take on as adults, this kind of threshold into the adult world, has for over a century been framed in different ways, some through a criminal justice movement, you know, the crackdown on drugs during the rise of neoliberalism in the late 20th century, more kids arrested for drugs, and returning vets being seen as drug addicts, even though there was data that challenged that assumption that vets were chronic drug addicts, that there's been this concern about how young adults are coping with the world we've created for them. And a more, I guess, progressive wing of this movement that goes all the way back to the child guidance movement that looks at not just diagnosing kids, and in fact approaches diagnosis in a very kind of soft way, and instead sees kids as acting out of a real dilemmas, what G. Stanley called the storms and stress of young adulthood and adolescence. And I think we're seeing that now with some calling for better diagnostic tools, expanding hospital beds, more treatment facilities, which has a place in the mental health system, but others who are saying, look, we have to look at the kind of society we're bringing kids into and everyday suffering that is part of that, that can't be framed through these diagnostic categories that we have available. So I think there's a lot to be said for the response of that letter to the editor.
Yeah, I recall when I was growing up, I went to a working class high school, but there are a lot of middle-class kids there, too, and striving kids. Quite a number of the, especially young men, were pretty tough and were getting into trouble. And for some of them, they wound up in the juvenile court or in the court system itself, if they were over 17 or whatever it was. And the judges would give them a sentence and then say, it's waived if you enter the Army. And these kids, most of them, in fact, did that. They had no other source of employment, really, and weren't sure of how to get it. And then they came out of the Army, and they were able to get, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I grew up, there were manufacturing jobs, and these guys went into unionized plants.
Yeah, and able to buy houses.
And they were able to buy a home and raise a family and send their kid to college and maybe even buy some golf clubs and play on the public links. It was a very different world. I mean, the Army followed by a good job that paid well and then a marriage and children created a life for these guys. That's not available now. And indeed, the Army... Well, of course, you could go into the Army, but that's afterwards. There's many, many, many veterans on the streets now. It seems to me we're in a different world for people, and the troubles of young people become enormously magnified because of the lack of a future that they see.
Yeah, and I'd like to also weigh in on the framing of that history from a mental health perspective. I think there's an interesting set of trends that I've followed over the last century or more, where including the women's movement in the late 19th century spawned a wave of interest in diagnosing women and also criminalizing abortion. That's another aspect of these historical trends, is, you know, when there's a campaign against the rights of youth or the rights of women to control their own bodies. But with the anti-war movement, with some of the youth movements of the 50s and 60s, the free speech movement, there was a wave of interest in child psychiatry or youth and adolescent psychiatry that emerged to frame the problems of youth in psychiatric terms. So even though I'm a psychologist, I'm always wary of when mental health people come into the social problem field and use their expertise to, as we say, name the problem. And, you know, for a very long time now, attention deficit disorder has gotten a lot of press, whether youth are being overdiagnosed and overtreated or what is basically a social condition and a pathologizing of some of the fluctuating, varying attention spans of youth that get framed as a disorder. And even though there are a lot of limits on psychiatry and how it can diagnose youth, especially personality disorders, that can be very damning to receive a diagnosis of a personality disorder. There are limits on how you can apply those categories. But there are, I think, ongoing struggles in the health and mental health field over how much of the problem is underdiagnosed or failure to treat serious mental disorders versus all of the other sources of distress that are captured in many of the same surveys of youth and mental health. For example, there are, 20% or so of adolescents who say they feel chronically lonely or isolated. There are 20% or so who have had thoughts of killing themselves. That's very different from people who actually attempt suicide. Suicidal ideation is fairly common. And I think collapsing all of these together loses sight of what G. Stanley Hall said in over a century ago, that adolescence and the entry into adulthood is a time of storm and stress, of figuring out where you land. And of course, as inequality is heightened and the fortunes and destinies of youth from very privileged families are quite a bit different now in terms of access to college, access to housing, access to secure employment, versus the growing number of youth who are trying to find their way in a much more uncertain world. But we also live now in a time where youth are organizing through the climate movement, even around mental health issues and the pandemic. Youth in many states, including Oregon, have fought for excuse from school for mental health reasons, as well as health, have led a lot of the organizing around the country to reduce the flow of guns and military weapons, which is highly associated with suicidality and successful suicides, is whether you have an access to a weapon and know how to use it. So there are, I think, always these threshold anxieties about a crisis among youth when youth themselves become more organized around their anger and the demands on adults in their society.
I'm talking to Jan Hocken. Jan Hocken's a practicing psychologist. Jan, one thing that was not mentioned at all in the Times thing is what you brought up. I think we should get into that in more detail. The organization of teens, which, again, I thought was notable at almost at it. Every level, they're really challenging the world that was given to them, and in articulate ways. They really are sophisticated beyond their years. Not all, but a sufficient number to, in fact, have a strong public presence. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting to follow the research and discourse that emerged last year around the criticisms of Facebook and whether it had fostered a dangerous trend of self-mutilation and suicidality among teenage girls. And there was much alarm about that, the impact of social media on youth, but particularly girls. It kind of echoed a similar kind of moral panic in the 80s and 90s over video games and boys, whether the availability of video games is causing all this psychopathic acting out among teenage boys and poisoning their minds and turning them into zombies. And a lot of that was debunked in terms of how boys have a more complex way of interacting with these games. And children do seek each other out and don't normally isolate for long periods of time. And the critics downplayed the more complex ways that kids use the tools of their time. And I think that similarly with social media, it's kind of interesting how a lot of the forward-looking mental health thinkers around the globe now are talking about youth organizing self-help and digital services, social media-based services for reaching out to each other around mental health concerns, but also around mobilizing for political organizing and building social movements. And, you know, I think the way youth organized around the country around gun violence and school walkouts around that a few years ago with minimal impact, as we see, although there's a shift now going after gun manufacturers, which is, I think, a new phase of that. But yeah, the ways that young people are organized, including in being less reluctant to identify so-called mental health issues, seeing yourself as not neurotypical, seeing yourself along a continuum of gender identities and having tendencies toward depression or anxiety. And these are, of course, artifacts in the screening questionnaires and tools available, the number of people that will acknowledge that they've thought about ending their lives. Because that there's a long history of taboo around that, where particularly the Catholic Church, the Christian churches in general, identify suicide as a sin, and it's a highly closeted source of tragedy in many families to have a family member kill themselves. But youth are much more, I think, open about this to the extent that there are generational cohort effects, which could be itself challenged, but there seems to be something about youth as an organizing category generationally that's certainly been taken up in the climate movement and social justice movements around gender justice, racial justice. So I would be cautious about framing what's going on now as a mental health crisis or emergency versus a time of tremendous peril and inequality that requires a political response, a transformative political response on the part of the governing interests. And youth are speaking out more about the governing interests and institutions that are taking us all toward a sadder and more perilous fate.
Right. Let's get further into the destigmatization that's going on now of the admissions by various athletes, for example, like Naomi Osaka, the tennis champion who retired for a year to deal with her mental health problems, now back on the circuit. Especially young people were enormously both, it seems to me, sympathetic with her and welcomed the direct way she dealt with it. I'm sure there were others before her, but even football players now, these helmeted robots, you know, sort of the height of masculinity and power and some brutality, they are now admitting to having problems of, they call it mental health, with problems where they doubt themselves, where they're fearful, all of the many human things that happen. That in the period, at least when I grew up, you had a stiff upper lip.
Yeah, the military launched a very ambitious campaign during the height of deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, where soldiers were serving multiple deployments, and they rolled out a destigma campaign around access to mental health services. It takes a strong soldier to get help. Those posters were everywhere at the VA. And, you know, in many ways, that was a good trend and responded to what was going on in the culture generally, and that young people were less afraid to acknowledge vulnerability and many of the conditions that had been stigmatized as mental health problems. I mean, I think it's also interesting to see Greta Thunberg and her openness about her autism as a leader in a movement where her oddness is an asset. And I think that's been really important for people to identify along what's called the spectrum, to have insights and to be seen as part of a social movement. It's always interesting to me how the mental health issues part of the discourse gets framed within the context of a larger social problem. And often clinicians very much narrow the context of this distress or this reaction or this symptom. But youth themselves are taking up, I think, collectively interesting ways of framing their own distress as a response to the horrifying predictions about a world that may be uninhabitable within decades and that calls for transformative social action and political action. So I think to the extent that youth are organizing and allowing space to support each other and acknowledging the costs of distress and despair and feelings of hopelessness, but holding something together, creating these spaces where people can come together and act collectively is, I think, the promising signs of mental health resiliency, as it's called among youth.
Jen, you concluded with one of your technical terms. Just out of the world of academic and theoretical psychology with a radical sensibility. You're a...
I've been influenced by the radical psychiatry movement.
You're also a very important
part of the social movements of the 60s and 70s. Yeah, that took up even having a psychotic episode as a reaction to an irrational social order. There's a long history of turning psychiatry on its head and saying, who are the crazy ones here in this world that we inhabit?
Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Okay, thanks, Bill. We'll have to check in again on this.
Yes, thank you.
That was Jan Hocken and Bill Resnick talking about the so-called crisis in teen mental health. You are listening to KBOO Portland and to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Only on KBOO are you going to hear ideas about the world that depart from the prevailing capitalist orthodoxy and an exploration of the ways we can collectively build a just, inclusive, and sustainable world. Please support our work by donating to KBOO today. Every donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $7,000. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thanks to all of you who give support to community radio. Sometimes, though not often, book mole Larry Bolden reads a book simply for the joy of it. Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garnes is such a book. But the 2022 novel also has lots to say about women in the sciences and the ways in which they are forced to work in the shadows of men who all too often take credit for the work the women do. Here's Larry to explain it all. I will be reading Larry's review for him. Elizabeth Zott is a brilliant chemist, who perhaps unfortunately is also beautiful. Quote, once a research chemist, Elizabeth Zott was a woman with flawless skin and an unmistakable demeanor of someone who was not average and never would be. End quote. The main character in Bonnie Garmus's delightful 2022 novel, Lessons in Chemistry, is as stubborn as she is brilliant. She refuses to be seen as simply an extension of her Nobel Prize-nominated boyfriend, whom she lives with but refuses to marry. Her hiring by a scientific think tank is already viewed by the male workforce as due to the influence of her famous boyfriend, and she realizes that no matter how brilliant her work is, she will be seen as riding the coattails of her boyfriend, Calvin Evans. Elizabeth meets Calvin when he discovers her stealing beakers from his lab, which she explains is due to a lack of funding for her research. Quote, the problem, Calvin, she asserted, is that half the population is being wasted. It's not just that I can't get the supplies I need to complete my work. It's that women can't get the education they need to do what they're meant to do. And even if they do attend college, it will never be in a place like Cambridge, which means they won't be offered the same opportunities nor afforded the same respect. They'll start at the bottom and stay there. And don't even get me started on pay. And all because they didn't attend a school that wouldn't admit them in the first place. End quote. The action in this novel takes place in the 60s, but Garmus thinks not much has changed since then. She creates some really funny and delightful characters, including a dog who understands a very large number of words, and a precocious daughter, quote, who could hum a Bach concerto but couldn't tie her own shoes, who could explain the Earth's rotation but stumbled at tic-tac-toe, end quote. The plot of the novel is less important than the commentary on science and society that Garmus provides. Briefly put, Calvin dies, and Elizabeth is fired from the research institute soon after his death. Out of a job and nearly broke, she has little to do but work on her already very accomplished cooking skills. Cooking, she insists, is like chemistry. In fact, it is chemistry at the practical level. Eventually, in this wacky story, Elizabeth becomes the reluctant star of a cooking show, Supper at Six. Unexpectedly, the show is a huge hit, and she soon has a devoted following. Between recipes, Elizabeth provides running commentary on the absurd exclusion of women from science, making them stay at home and make babies in a form of legalized slavery. The all-male workforce at the Institute sees Elizabeth's research project as unimportant and bound to go nowhere, and after she is fired, her work is simply stolen by one of her male colleagues. Only Calvin recognizes her brilliance, and he is no longer there to defend her. Quote, Darwin had long ago proposed that life sprang from a single-celled bacterium, which then went on to diversify into a complex planet of people, plants, and animals. Zot? She was like a bloodhound on the trail of where that first cell had come from. In other words, she was out to solve one of the greatest chemical mysteries of all time, and if her findings continued apace, there was no question she would do just that. End quote. As her fame blossoms as cooking show host, Elizabeth has only one real friend, Harriet, whom Elizabeth has hired as her assistant. They agree on most things, but not on one essential point. Quote, according to Harriet, men were a world apart from women. They required coddling. They had fragile egos. They couldn't allow a woman intelligence or skill if it exceeded their own. Harriet, that's ridiculous, Elizabeth had argued. Men and women are both human beings. And as humans, we're byproducts of our upbringings, victims of our lackluster educational system, and choosers of our behaviors. In short, the reduction of women to something less than men and the elevation of men to something more than women is not biological, it's cultural. End quote. I did not choose this book for its political significance, but simply because it sounded delightful, and it is. Bonnie Garmus has worked widely in the fields of technology, medicine, and education, and she shows off her considerable talents in this wonderful comedic novel. Like her zany character Elizabeth, Bonnie decides, don't work the system, outsmart it. If you, as a reader, sometimes read a book just for the delight of reading it, this is a book for you. Easily the funniest and most clever book I have read this year. I've been talking about Bonnie Garmus's novel, Lessons in Chemistry. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and this is Patricia Kohlberg reading today for Larry.
There once was a gal named Hypatia. She'd beat you in spades if she raced ya. She'd philosophize you to mere smithereens, but not in a way that disgraced ya. Hypatia was smarter than you are in math and in science, a rock star.
That was from a song called Hypatia of Alexandria by Sally Rogers and Claudia Schmidt. Hypatia was a philosopher, astronomer, and mathematician in Egypt, born late in the 4th century. Renowned during her own lifetime for her wisdom, Hypatia was murdered by a Christian mob, incensed in part by her pagan beliefs. Before that, we heard Larry Bolden's review of the novel Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garnas. We are at the end of our spring drive and have nearly reached our goal of raising $56,000. Every dollar you donate will be matched by a grant from a group of generous supporters up to $7,000. KBOO relies on listeners like you to keep community radio alive. If you can, please support KBOO by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. We now turn to the last part of Joe Clement's three-part interview with Emily Drabinsky, president-elect of the American Library Association. In an election that saw more votes cast than any other in the ALA's history, Emily won on a campaign of organizing for collective power for public good. They consider how libraries could fit into a Green New Deal and the challenge of changing capitalist norms that have crept into libraries. Joe?
I wanted to ask also about one element of your campaign having to do with a Green New Deal and where you see libraries fitting into that. Now, obviously, libraries can play a role in educating the public about climate change and what we can do about it. But what they're actually doing can libraries be doing to address climate change?
Well, I think when I think about libraries as part of a Green New Deal as public institutions, because like I can't actually think of another public institution that takes up real estate the way that libraries do. Schools, you know, but in terms of non-coercive public space for people of all ages to come inside, you know, we're the only ones, you know, where you don't come in and get sold something. Like that's us. That's kind of it. And so I think to the extent that a Green New Deal is about pushing reinvestment in physical institutions and infrastructure, we have to be a part of that. And I think that's really important. I also think we can argue about libraries and how they have failed society and the ways that they, you know, racial exclusion is at the root of libraries, the sort of paternalistic effort to, you know, inform the working classes about better ways to be, you know, all of those things are true, but also libraries are kind of amazing and they're kind of great and they kind of do good things. And like, they're really institutions that it's much easier to mobilize them on behalf of justice than say like the post office. So we're inclined in those ways. And so I think, you know, sustainability is a core value now for the American Library Association. It has, the association has set up infrastructure for environmental conversations and sustainability efforts. Rebecca Smith Aldrich is a librarian here in New York, has done an amazing organizing job around sustainability in New York State libraries and across the country, but really in New York State, there's a lot of really good stuff happening. And so I think because we are good, you know, with all of the qualifying scare quotes around that, I think we can be sites for environmental activism in a way that other institutions can't be.
You mentioned sustainability, and one way that we could be doing better as stewards of material resources is in just how we actually take care of them. Because libraries used to have to repair and maintain everything because, you know, books were not produced as readily 100 or more years ago. Production techniques, extraction techniques have brought all of those costs down so that it is more economical to just throw out a book, which is often designed to be disposable, than it is to repair it and give it however many more circs it's going to get. And I feel like that is a trend in our society, but then also just in collection management that we could be doing better to push back against and basically say, we're not always going to have shiny new books on the shelves. We're going to have books that are cared for, though.
Yeah, there's a bindery crisis. Like during the pandemic, a bunch of the binderies closed. So if you want to send out your book for rebinding, there are like fewer and fewer places you can send it. It's like a crisis. Also, like we have, I think, pivoted to digital in some fairly uncritical ways, as if digital materials don't have very extraordinarily high resource costs. So there's a lot of reckoning with our use of digital materials, as well as, I think you're right, the like, could the library be a site for sort of right to repair movements to really take off, rather than conceiving of our maker spaces as just for business innovation, which is how they're normally pitched, you know? But if I'm going to pitch that and have it be successful, that's why I need to link whatever I'm doing, activism I'm doing in and around the library, to broader social movements that would make that possible.
Well, yeah. And you would think that there would be a big buy-in across libraries, because that would mean jobs. That would mean labor hours that have to be put to that kind of work. And, you know, there's something more wholesome about repairing and taking care of things than clicking the marketplace button that'll just send another one from Amazon.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of disposability stuff that we have to reckon with, and that libraries traditionally, you know, one of our roles has been to preserve for use over time. But, you know, we're, a lot of us really stuck in a sort of innovation story, when I think what we need is really, you know, to pay attention to what it is that libraries do best, which is make space and knowledge available. And I think we could do that ethically if we chose to.
Yeah, you brought up ebooks, and it's a question that a fellow library worker had kind of pitched to me to bring up, which is that, is there anything the ALA could be doing to kind of create a counter publishing institution for digital resources? Because ebooks were pushed on libraries and in the broader public to some extent, saying, hey, we're going to save trees. Mm-hmm. And in libraries, you have checkout limits on these, you know, infinitely checkoutable items. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, here it's because publishers want to enforce this scarcity and get their money's worth out of everything. Could the ALA, you know, use those economies of scale, since it wouldn't have to produce books, it would just have to manage server space or something. Mm-hmm. Is there room for the ALA to kind of create a public option for ebook publishing that would then get around those artificial scarcities?
I mean, I don't know, right? Like, we would have to find out. But I think that, like, does the association have that capacity? I don't know. I think there are other entities that are sort of moving in that direction with like controlled digital lending. I'm less sort of familiar with those kinds of projects, but I think, you know, we see what most actors in the space are doing, and it's to, you know, most of what we do is try to maximize profit, right? That's most of what everybody is doing. And so could ALA be a counter to that? I don't know. It would have to be a different kind of ALA than the one it is now, I think. I mean, I think part of what my election means, at least from where I sit, is that we can have more of these open conversations. Like, I think it doesn't feel like an honorific. It feels like a real opportunity to like get people together in a room to talk about what we care about, and sort of making room for people with commitments to the public and commitments to each other to like be driving the conversation seems really exciting.
I know that you said in one interview that with the like $75,000 discretionary budget you'll get, that you thought of like funding labor notes trainings in libraries or somehow adjacent to them. Is that something that you're still considering?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how it works, or even if that's the amount or what I get to, how discretionary it really is. But I think my goal is to make sure that during my time as president, more people know the basic how-tos of organizing than did before I got there. And what shape that takes, I'm not totally sure. My own experience in a labor notes training was transformative. It's one of the only times I've ever been in a room with organized labor from across the spectrum, like everybody in the country, like Teamsters, longshoremen, Verizon workers, Starbucks workers, I'm sure we're going to see teachers, librarians, all those people. And so you don't often get to be in a cross-class, I don't get to have cross-class experiences very often, you know, and the library space is one of those places where you can have those encounters. But labor notes, where everybody understands that it is only through collective action with each other as workers that we really sort of like, who sees that as like the primary driver of change. It's sort of, I'd like to, more people to have that experience, because it was really transformative for me. That's where our resources need to be going. And, you know, over the last 5 years, I've sent out probably 500 copies of Secrets of a Successful Organizer. I try to put that in the hands of every single person that I meet who has a complaint about their boss, because that's the only way you're going to win. It's a good how-to. It's like, should be required reading in library school.
I mean, and I have a lot of hope for libraries being catalysts for other sorts of organizing. We did a lot of tenant organizing in Portland about 5-7 years ago when gentrification was just on fire in town. I got evicted. Lots of people got evicted. We had renters assemblies that because I've been working for the library for 8 years now. Mm-hmm. I said, we have to do these in the library. It's free space and it's going to make people feel like there's something legitimate about it because there's a social cachet that the library casts on whatever happens in its walls.
It's that public space accessible to all kind of thing. Like we have material infrastructure that can help people, you know, and we've sort of framed it mostly as the sort of access to tech, but it's also just like access to space to be with one another. And that's no small thing.
Yeah. And there's ways in which there's contradictions in that access. Cause management right now, they want to say that, well, the library is changing and we need to make more space and be more flexible for community events, which sounds okay. But they're also talking about devaluing, I think, the work that goes into maintaining the collection. Automation is one way that happens. Just the fact that when we got a $15 minimum wage in our contract 6 years ago, they said that your jobs to the pages who are getting an increase because of that, your jobs aren't worth that. So we're going to give you more work so that the taxpayers are getting the value they deserve.
I mean, I don't even know what you say to that. It's just an absolutely, I don't know why we would treat each other that way. It just is mystifying to me why we would choose to have that as sort of the form of our social relations. But the dream for me is that when people hear about their library or a library in their community doing something like that, that we all feel like we can do more than be mad about it. That rage without a way of acting on it in a collective way that builds our community, it's just will eat you to death. And I can't wake up every morning knowing that I'm right, but the people who are wrong have all the power, right? Because that is just a recipe for despair. And we don't have time for despair. There's too much we have to do. There's too much that needs to be different. And so I want the first thought somebody has when they're like, I can't believe my boss is doing that, not to be, I guess I hate the boss and I have to get a new job, but what are we going to do to get something different to happen, to change that decision? And that is that is the question that we have to always be asking ourselves and asking each other and putting ourselves into positions where we can learn how to do that. And that's sort of the gamble I made with running for president, that I'd be able to talk to enough people and generate enough excitement and figure out enough ways to bring people together to sort of build that capacity for us. We'll see what I can actually do, but not me, us, right? It's going to take all of us.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been talking with Emily Drabinsky, the new president-elect of the American Library Association. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Emily.
Thank you so much.
You just heard the concluding segment of an interview by Joe Clement with Emily Drabinsky of the American Library Association. Links to parts 1 and 2 are already posted to our KBOO webpage at kboo.fm. To close our show this morning, Bill Resnick offers a well-read read and then a commentary on U.S. motives in the Ukraine war. The well-read read is excerpted by Bill from an op-ed in the May 11 New York Times titled, America and its Allies Want to Bleed Russia. They really shouldn't. The op-ed raised the question of why the U.S. shelved its demand for negotiations and thereby increased the risk of expanded war that could possibly employ nuclear weapons. But the op-ed did not speculate on answers. Bill's commentary suggests why, that it's a warning to China about U.S. determination to maintain global supremacy, a warning China will surely brush off. Here's an excerpt from the op-ed. The war in Ukraine has entered a new phase. It is no secret that the initial invasion went badly for Russia. Expecting easy victories, the Russian army inflicted terrible destruction, especially on Ukraine's cities, but for the most part failed to take territory outside the southeast of the country. Ukrainian resistance was fierce. After 6 weeks of war, undermanned Russian forces were made to retreat from Kiev and its suburbs. In the hope of winning new victories, Russia has now confined its forces to the south and east of Ukraine. In response, the United States and its allies have also shifted their position. At first, the Western support for Ukraine was mainly designed to defend against the invasion. It is now set on a far grander ambition, to weaken Russia itself. Presented as a common sense response to Russian aggression, the shift in fact amounts to a significant escalation. By expanding support to Ukraine across the board and shelving any diplomatic effort to stop the fighting, the United States and its allies have greatly increased the danger of an even larger conflict. They are taking a risk far out of step with any realistic strategic gain. The op-ed ends with this. Diplomatic efforts ought to be the centerpiece of a new Ukraine strategy. Instead, the war's boundaries are being expanded and the war itself recast as a struggle between democracy and autocracy, in which the Donbass, the mostly Russian-speaking region being fought over, is the frontier of freedom. This is not just declamatory extravagance, it is reckless. The risks hardly need to be stated.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning.
You just heard excerpts from an op-ed by Tom Stevenson titled America and Its Allies Want to Bleed Russia. They really shouldn't. And that music clip was from a song titled War Pigs by Black Sabbath. Next on The Mole, here's Old Mole Bill Resnick's commentary on why U.S. foreign policy and military elites are bleeding Russia to near death. Bill suggests it's to send a lesson to China that they will very likely brush off. Here's Bill, but in my voice. So, Old Mole listeners, Tom Stevenson did not hazard an opinion on why the U.S. is taking such big risks in trying to bleed Russia when it is so weak, an economic and political basket case that would not be worth any attention but for its oil and nuclear weapons. One school of thought has it that our national elites, mostly old white men, hate communism so much that they would put a stake in the heart of Karl Marx and its Russian communist atheist original project. A much better answer is that the U.S. wants to teach China a lesson, that you can't win in a fight with the United States, and so stop trying or we'll bleed you to death just like we're bleeding Russia. But China knows that's an empty threat. Because unlike Russia, headed by Putin and his oligarch capitalist mob, state capitalist China is an incredible success, challenging the U.S. both economically and militarily. Over the last 30 years, it's become the manufacturing hub of the world. It will surpass the U.S. in total manufacturing output by 2030. It already passed the U.S. greenhouse gas pollution, and its unprecedented growth rate will draw its equal to the U.S. in production per person in an estimated 30 to 40 years. Like the U.S., China is trading partners with all the major other countries on the planet, which trade is necessary for each of those countries. If the U.S. ever tried comprehensive economic sanctions on China, as the U.S. successively sanctioned Russia after its invasion of Ukraine, Maybe only Israel and Guatemala would agree, and the U.S. would wind up isolated. And even more worrisome for U.S. elites, China has developed and is successfully operating an international trade, banking, and investment system as an alternative to the U.S. system that privileges U.S. companies. And most of the major countries of the world are active on China's system, though with much less activity than on the U.S. system. To be sure, the U.S. spends more on its military, maintaining and increasing its nuclear weapons, provisioning its over 700 bases across the planet, and an air force, missile force, and naval force active everywhere on the planet and also in outer space. This whole military apparatus is also patrolling the South China Sea, trying to keep China from exercising power in its neighborhood, particularly wanting to take over Hong Kong and Taiwan. Indeed, both U.S. and Chinese warships and fighter planes are having dogfights, but with their weapons sheathed. But neither the U.S. nor China want a real war. And like for the Russians in the Ukraine, their nukes are useless. Right now, the world is very unstable, and human life stands in the balance. Nuclear war is possible, probably more by accident than by attention, but the virtual end of the human experience on Earth is possible. And probably more threatening is the increasing concentration of greenhouse gas emissions and the rise of global temperatures that create a planet virtually uninhabitable by humans. The great hope, indeed the only hope, is that U.S. and China put aside their differences and lead to form an international partnership to reconstruct the economies of near every country. Today, U.S. elites have no time and interest in that. They are perfectly willing to ignore climate scientists and risk human extinction in order to maintain their wealth and dominant position around the world. It will take great movements from below in this country to eject them from the halls of power. More on that in coming editions of Your Old Mole. You just heard an online op-ed by Bill Resnick, read by me, in response to a New York Times op-ed entitled America and Its Allies Want to Bleed Russia. They really shouldn't. A link to the full piece is posted on the Old Mole's webpage at kboo.fm. That's a wrap for the show today. I'd like to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Larry Bolden, and Joe Clement for their contributions, and John Nelson for his editing assistance. A special thanks to our guest, Emily Drabinski. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. During its more than 50 years on the air, KBOO has taught thousands of volunteers how to do radio, all for free, giving voice to the multiplicity of communities that make up our city. We've almost reached our goal of raising $56,000 during our spring drive. You can help to put us over the finish line. Every dollar you donate will be matched up to $7,000 by a grant from a group of generous KBOO supporters. You can go to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. Catch us again next Monday morning.